Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the nurse and humanitarian Dame Claire Birchinger. She's worked for the Red Cross in over a dozen countries, including Sudan, Sierra Leone, Kenya, Afghanistan, Lebanon and Liberia. Amid the sort of raw human suffering that most of us find, even on the TV, virtually unbearable to witness. In fact, it was through Michael Burke's landmark news reports on the Ethiopian famine 30 years ago that she first grabbed our attention. We saw her as a young nurse surrounded by thousands of starving people and forced daily to make the truly terrible decision of choosing who to feed. Throughout the years, she's won numerous plaudits and awards, but her Florence Nightingale Medal pretty much says it all, given to honour those who've distinguished themselves in times of war by exceptional courage and devotion to the wounded, sick or disabled. She says, "I don't just live to eat and sleep and get money to have a nice house. I have to create value. I have to do something in life." Let's talk first of all then, Claire, about this impulse to do something. For you, it has meant devoting your life to being in parts of the world where people are really suffering.
No, I think that's much too serious. That is, I just, in my life, I just like to get up and do things rather than just... I'm not very good at sitting down reading a book, let's put it that way.
Right. I'm going to get a little bit serious with you, and you're going to have to bear with me on this, because this year is the 150th anniversary of the Geneva Convention, something that's been a sort of guiding principle for you in a very real way. Why is it important to you?
It's the one flash of humanity in all wars. So this flash of red you see is the Red Cross. And the first Geneva Convention was about care of the sick and the wounded and prisoners, and not to shoot the nurses and doctors. And if you think about now in Syria, the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, there's been 34 nurses that have been, or volunteers that have died, and many more have been detained or have gone missing. And these are volunteers. So humanities and the Red Cross and the Geneva Conventions is just as important now as it ever was.
Well, talk about handbrake turns. I'm about to ask you to introduce a piece of music that people will not be expecting. Tell us about this first choice this morning then. What is it and why have you chosen
okay, it? Okay, it's a teeny weeny yellow polka dot bikini. In my childhood, I was brought up very much in the countryside, and during the summer holidays, we often all piled into a car. I've got two other brothers and a sister. And we travelled across Europe via Switzerland, because we've got relatives in Switzerland, down to the south of France, and spend our summer holidays on a beach and just lived in our bikinis. It was an itsy bitsy teeny weeny yellow polka dot bikini that she wore for the first time today. An itsy bitsy teeny weeny yellow polka dot bikini. So in the blanket she wanted to stay.
2, 3, 4, stick around, we'll tell you more. Now she's afraid to come out of the water.
Brian Hyland singing Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini, and memories for you, Claire, of being on the beach in France for all those happy summers with your family, camping under the stars and enjoying the life outdoors. You said that you would drive through Switzerland because you'd Swiss relatives.
Yes.
Were both your parents Swiss?
No, my father was Swiss. In fact, my grandparents came over here. They met over here. They were Swiss. So although my father was born here, he did a lot of his education in Switzerland.
So tell me, first of all, then, a little bit more about your mother. What was she like?
My mummy was lovely. My mother was from the East End of London, and she was really great fun to be with, and always... She used to tell us about... I can't be doing housework all the time because the house is always going to be dirty. And as soon as I've cleaned it up, it's going to be dirty again. So come on, let's go outside and have fun. And she used to call it flying the kites, because you have to fly the kites when there's wind. So you have to pick the right moment.
Tell me about your dad then. What was his background?
He was Swiss nationality, although he was born here in Britain. He joined the Swiss army, which was obligatory for Swiss nationals, And then war broke out. And so he came back to Britain and joined up with the British Army and served throughout the war. He was very strict, loved teaching us to be self-sufficient, to be prepared, to be loyal. It was very important. My mother used to preserve a lot of vegetables and fruit in the old Kilner jars, very old. And his vegetable patch was very regimented, typical Swiss. I remember we were very different as other families. And I couldn't really put my finger on it, but I know we did things very differently and we were seen as foreign.
In terms of being prepared, I mean, what did he want you to be prepared for?
Be prepared for everything in life, be self-sufficient. I think the main thing, when I first realised what he was, in inverted commas, training me for, is when I joined the Red Cross. And I remember him saying, you know, quietly too much, you know, you can't rely on people. You've got to be able to stand on your own 2 feet, Claire, when you're in war.
And he made sure that you had Anglo-Swiss citizenship. And
he
actually
did.
That was crucial to what you would end up doing.
It was, because I joined the International Committee of the Red Cross, which is the Swiss branch of the Red Cross. He was very proud of being Swiss, which I am as well.
Time for some more music, Claire Bertschinger. Tell me about what we're going to hear now. It's your second choice.
Our second choice is the Song of Hiawatha. I used to carry this in a little booklet around with me, and it brings back to me all what my life was about as a child. It's about calmness and happiness. And it's about Hiawatha, who comes out of his tent and the sun is rising and streaming through the trees, and he's got bare feet and on the ground and the dew, and he can smell the moisture in the air, and he can hear the bees and the humming and the birds singing. And when I read it, I don't actually read the words. These pictures pop up and I'm home again. I'm home at the end of the garden in the woods. Oh, and the other main thing is, I was Hiawatha. I didn't know Hiawatha was a man when I was reading it. So I was Hiawatha and I was standing there, and I was immediately back home and calm.
By the shore of Gitche-Gumee, by the shining big sea water, at the doorway of his wigwam, in the pleasant summer morning, Hiawatha stood and waited. All the air was full of freshness, all the earth was bright and joyous, and before him through the sunshine, westward toward the neighbouring forest, passed in golden swarms the amo, passed the bees, the honey-makers, burning, singing in the sunshine. Bright above him shone the heavens, level spread the lake before him. From its bosom leapt the sturgeon, sparkling, flashing in the sunshine. On its margin the great forest stood reflected in the water. Every tree-top had its shadow, motionless beneath the water.
That was part of Hiawatha, written by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, read there by Peter Yearsley. And you said, Claire, as we went into that, that when you're enjoying that piece of poetry, you're not reading it, you're seeing it and feeling the sensations.
I have to see it,
yeah. You're dyslexic. Now, when you were at school, there wasn't that much at that point that was understood or known about dyslexia.
Yeah.
How did you get on?
I was bottom of my class, and I was put in a class a year younger than me, and I was still pretty near the bottom of that one. And when I look back at it, the words didn't really make sense at all. So I was given the title as a late developer. And when I was 15, 16, I knew I wanted to be a nurse. And then I suggested to do a pre-nursing course at Loughton College of Further Education. And that allowed me to be more practical and spend one day a week in a hospital. And at that time also, the O-levels were put as projects. So I used to do a project perhaps on health visiting and go and take photographs, and I could write a sentence under the photographs of what I'd seen. So I managed to get enough exams to get into nursing.
And you said you knew you wanted to be a nurse. When did you know?
All my life, I always knew I wanted to be a nurse. When I was bandaging my teddies, I knew I was going to be a nurse, and I knew I was going to work in Africa.
You did your training at, it was St Mary's Hospital in Paddington in London. Mm. I wonder what it was. You said, I knew I wanted to work abroad. I knew I wanted to be a nurse. Where was the motivation?
Well, I didn't want to put myself in danger. I just enjoyed nursing. I was good at accident and emergency type of work. I got quite depressed with long-term care of people. That really upset me. So I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do trauma. And I was good at it in war zones, because it was a lot of first aid.
I want to talk about your time in Lebanon. Crossing the front lines, you were meeting people who, they called themselves freedom fighters. They were people who had killed, they were people who were using armoury. Tell me what it was like when you met them.
When I was in Lebanon, I was based in Saida, which was south of Beirut. It was controlled by the Israelis at the time. And in any one day, I used to take the car and or some ambulances and cross the front lines into a Shiite-held area, Sunni-held area, a Druze militia area, a Christian-held village, and a Palestinian camp. And every time, you had to arrange ceasefires. So I can remember getting out of the Red Cross vehicle and going up to them just to talk to them. And they're covered in Kalashnikovs and grenades and bullets. And I'm thinking, gosh, and I knew they'd killed and tortured people. And then when I started talking to them, what surprised me was they started talking about their families, their mothers, their children, where they were going to go to school, their houses. And I suddenly realised that these weren't killers as a title, so-called, we called them. These were human beings. And they wanted peace. And eventually I managed to arrange a ceasefire for a certain time and cross over into the next fighting factions to these killers over here in trepidation. And what do I meet? Again, I meet these human people who worry about their families and say they're the ones that raped my sister. We want peace. We're fighting for peace. And I just think this is bizarre. And every fighting factions I went between, it was like this, whatever religion they were. And I thought there has to be an alternative. And that's what started me on my quest to look for an alternative.
Let's get some more music then. We're on your third choice of the morning. Tell me about this, Claire Berchinger. What are we going to hear now?
Now we're going to hear The Rose of No Man's Land. The music was given to me by my mother when I came back from my first mission with the Red Cross in Lebanon in the 80s. And she gave it to me and said, here, Claire, my friends and I decided this is you. And her friends were from her Keep Fit group. She did Keep Fit all her life, right up until the year she died, which was when she was 94. And so gigglingly, they sang this song to me.
That was recorded in 1916, William Thomas and Orchestra and The Rose in No Man's Land. And you said, of course, going into that, Claire, it was so important to you, that piece of music.
It was composed during the First World War.
Yes.
And, you know, when you're in war, you are shot at and you've got shells flying all over the place. And when I hear that, I can feel myself back in the battlefield. And I can remember actually one person, I can remember loads of times, but there's one during the coup d'etat in Sierra Leone. I was there when this guy got shot on the streets, this young man. And he said to me, oh, he looked down and saw his stomach open. He said, oh, look what's happened. Am I going to die? I'm going to die. And I remember saying, it's all right, don't worry, we'll be all right. We'll sort you out. And it's an awful feeling knowing someone's going to die and still having to reassure them. And you've also got to remember that in the world today, there are thousands of Red Cross nurses and doctors and volunteers in war zones just like me, doing the similar things.
Tell me what we're going to hear next, your fourth disc.
The fourth one is another poem, and it's called The Green Eye of the Little Yellow God. Now, I went very fortunate enough to go on expeditions called Operation Drake, and it was Lieutenant Colonel John Blashford Snell, an amazing motivational character who's given the opportunities to thousands of youth to challenge themselves. I went with them in Panama, Papua New Guinea and Sulawesi in Indonesia. When I went for my interview, they said, you know, you'll be filthy dirty and you won't be able to wash and, you know, it'd be really difficult, spiders and snakes everywhere. And are you sure you want to go? And I said, yes, that's just what I want. Ideal. Anyway, I can remember the first week we went there, I was with one other girl called Caroline and me and about 30 men to build a runway, so that we could land a small plane if necessary. And they said, right, you girls, the cooking's over there and you've got the food in the tins over there. And I said, I don't want to cook. I want to help. I want to use a machete and cut down trees. And they said, oh, no, no, you can't do that. And I thought, blow this for a lark. So we went and cooked, but I forgot, inverted commas, the salt. And things got burnt. So after a week, we were doing a rotor system and I was allowed out to have fun cutting down trees and clearing the runway. And we didn't have electricity. We didn't have iPods or radios. So we used to sit round the campfire at night and often talk and chat and sing and sometimes read a monologue. And this particular monologue was said by one of the Royal Engineers. And he was with the expedition to build a jungle walkway 100 feet up in the jungle canopy. And I got a bit bored waiting down below in camp waiting for somebody to be sick or to have a cold or need a headache tablet. So I used to actually join him up the jungle and helped him build the walkway, which I thoroughly enjoyed.
There's a one-eyed yellow idol to the north of Kathmandu. There's a little marble cross below the town. There's a broken-hearted woman tends the grave of Mad Karoo. And that yellow god forever gazes down. He was known as Mad Karoo by the subs at Kathmandu. He was hotter than they felt inclined to tell. But for all his foolish pranks, he was worshipped in the ranks. And the colonel's daughter smiled on him as well. He'd loved her from the start. Perhaps she knew it in her heart. The fact that she loved him was plain to all. She was nearly 21, and arrangements had begun to celebrate her birthday with a ball. He wrote to ask what present she would like from Mad Karoo. They met next day as he dismissed a squad, and jestingly she told him that nothing else would do but the green eye of the little yellow god.
That was Bransby Williams reading part of The Green Eye of the Yellow God, written by J. Milton Hayes. You'd been working in Lebanon for a year then, Claire Birchinger, when you were moved in 1984 to the Tigray province in Ethiopia. You were running a feeding station there, as I understand it, and the numbers grew and grew and grew by hundreds each day. You only had enough food for maybe feeding 50, 60 people in a day, and there were days that were designated selection days.
That's right.
Can you explain to me what would happen on a selection day?
On a selection day, somebody had to go out and select whatever place we had. We might have 50 or 60 places in one day, and there would be hundreds outside. I can remember one day counting 10 rows of children, and in each row there was over 100 children, and I had 60 or 70 places, and I thought, how on earth am I going to do this? The locals couldn't do it because they said, that's our cousins, that's our sisters, our brothers, we can't do it, you've got to go and do it. So we decided between us that I would go up and down the lines and look at every child and then just put a little mark on them if I chose them. And we didn't choose the ones who were the worst because we knew they would die within the first few days. So I choose the ones which sort of have a spark of life in their eyes. They were all extremely malnourished and they were all, I knew they would die within the next couple of weeks. So, and that was the most horrendous thing is knowing the ones you didn't choose wouldn't survive because there was no food at all.
In the midst of all of this, suddenly lands upon the doorstep, if I can call it that, a television reporter called Michael Burke and a cameraman. What did you think when they arrive?
I was told they were coming, And they came in the door and they said, right, let's get some filming, stand over there. Let's get some really sick children, Claire. Would you like to hold that one? And then he started asking me questions. And I can remember him asking me, so, Claire, what's it feel like choosing those who can live?
He said, does it do anything to you, I think, was his
exact
question.
Does it do anything, did he? There we go. Ridiculous. And I just, well, what do you expect? It breaks my heart. And I just couldn't get rid of them fast enough because I just thought, this is ridiculous. I don't want these people around me.
And, of course, Michael Burke, even at that point in 1984, a hugely experienced journalist and television reporter, he was doing exactly what he needed to do,
absolutely,
which was to get that information, as stark and revolting as it was, out there to the millions of people who were sitting at home who had no idea that the crisis was happening.
Absolutely.
And we know the effect that his reports had, and we are going to, you're smiling now, we're going to talk about the effect that his reports had as they were broadcast to millions on the BBC in just a moment. But I'm going to ask you to fit in your next choice of disc. Tell me what we're going to hear now.
We're going to hear now the theme from Out of Africa, the flying theme. Now, because I knew I wanted to work abroad, I thought I had to do midwifery if I was going to work abroad. And I spent 3 months in the obstetric unit when I was a student nurse. And I thought, I couldn't stand it. So I thought, oh, I'm never going to be able to go abroad. What am I going to do? So I had read an article about the flying doctor service and I thought, right, I'll learn to fly. Then I can join the flying doctor service. So I managed, out of my nurse's pay, to be able to afford just about 1 hour's flying a month. And when I was with the Red Cross, particularly in Ethiopia and Kenya, we flew at 500 feet above the grounds and snuck up on the animals. I mean, Africa is such a beautiful country.
Theme from the film Out of Africa, composed by John Barry. So, Claire Birchinger, it was on October 23rd that the first of Michael Burke's films was shown in Britain on the 9 o'clock news. The impact of those reports, of course, was enormous. Not long after those reports were shown, the first plane carrying aid that was generated by people's donations was on its way to where you were. Tell me about that plane's arrival. What do you remember of that?
I can remember being told that a British Hercules plane was going to arrive, and would I go out and meet it? And there was a building which was used as an air traffic control, which was all broken down and there was no windows in it. And there was a few herders with some goats and cows on the runway walking around. And I stood there and I just enjoyed the morning and watched the sunrise. And then far, far in the distance, I could hear noise and see this black spot sort of jump over the mountains and come towards me and get bigger and bigger and bigger. And it was this massive plane. And it landed in a hail of stones and shingles and dust. And they opened the back doors and it was just full of food. And I thought, wow, we're saved. It was just amazing.
Those reports not just inspired people to begin giving, the giving continued and was solidified by Bob Geldof and Midge Ure setting up Live Aid and the big concerts that happened both here and in the United States. They created Band Aid, of course. There was the single, Do They Know It's Christmas? What did you think of all of that? How much did you know about all of that?
I didn't really know at all about it. I did hear several weeks down the line this song on the radio, shortwave radio, and it was Feed the World, Do They Know It's Christmas Time by Band Aid. And I thought, well, you need more than a bloody Band Aid to feed this place. All the money was going to Ethiopia, and I thought, well, where's the money? It hasn't come here. How dare they? And they don't know it's Christmas because Ethiopia has a completely different calendar, so it's not Christmas here anyway. So I got completely the wrong end of the stick because I didn't understand what was going to go on.
And so, when did you realise the true effect that Michael Burke's television reports had had at the time that they had been broadcast here?
I spent a year in Ethiopia, and when I came back, I can remember, to Britain, I had 2 weeks' holiday, and I remember people telling me what a wonderful job I'd done and how wonderful saving all those thousands of lives. And I was explaining to them, actually, I didn't do a good job. There was thousands of children who had died, and I couldn't help them. And they kept, people kept saying, no, you did a wonderful job, Claire, you know. And I just thought, well, no, you're not listening to me. You've got to listen to me. That's not the case out there. It's a horrendous situation. And so after about 10 days, I thought, well, if you're not going to listen to me, I won't talk about it. So I didn't talk about it, and I kept quiet for 20 years. And the BBC asked me to go back in 2003 to make an anniversary programme. And so when they rang me up and asked me to go back with Michael Burke, I was horrified because I felt responsible for those I wasn't able to help. And I thought I'd be vilified when I went back.
The people you hadn't chosen.
Mm.
The sisters and the brothers people. And yeah. That, yes.
Mm.
So you did go back, and what happened?
I did. It was amazing. I was welcomed with open arms, which surprised me. And I remember Michael taking me to... We actually found the feeding centre, which was overgrown, and we climbed in over the fence and stood there, and he interviewed me and started talking to me about my experience. And I told him the example about the plane arriving. And as I was being filmed telling him, he started to cry. And I thought, wow, he's crying. And I thought, he understands. This is amazing. And then they started talking about Bob Geldof, and they showed me a film. They showed me Bob Geldof talking about his experience of seeing me being filmed by Michael Burke. And he started to get emotional and cry when he was talking about it. And again, I thought, wow, this person, he really understands.
So for all those years, you'd kept all of those feelings, just you'd put them away. Was it life... I mean, I don't want to get clichéd about it, but was it literally a life-changing event to go back and to understand that other people did understand? Did it change you that much?
Yeah. Yes.
Let's take a break and have your next choice then. We're on your sixth of the day. Tell me about this.
This one is If by Rudyard Kipling. It just means something very special. And when I was in Afghanistan, I had it translated into Dari. And just a couple of years ago, I heard on the BBC that one of my Afghani nurses was actually reciting If. And he said he'd received it back in the wartime from a nurse.
If, Rudyard Kipling. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good nor talk too wise. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same, if you can bear to hear the truths you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to, broken, and stoop and build them up with worn-out tools.
Michael Caine reading Rudyard Kipling's If. At one point on your travels, Claire Birchinger, you contracted malaria, which meant that you had to give up travelling to malarial areas for good. I'm wondering how much that affected you. That must have been a real pain in the neck.
Oh, it was awful. I was casuvac back to Geneva, and I got a job in the health division as training officer in Geneva. And I was thought, this is awful. I used to have a flat overlooking this beautiful park in Geneva, and these mothers used to go around there and have picnics for their children. And I just thought, this life is so boring here. What's life all about? And I thought, you know, what can I do here? You know, I just didn't feel I belonged there at all. For me, life was about at the front line, picking up the wounded, healing them. And I can do that. That's great. Now, all of a sudden, I couldn't go and do the work which I thought I was good at.
Given then that so much of your impulse is to make your life matter and your contribution matter, what did you do to make it feel like actually, you know, this was a life that had some importance to it?
I spent a lot of my time in the mountains. I had a cousin who had a chalet in the mountains. It was an old cow shed, no running water, no electricity. And I used to go up into the mountains by myself and just enjoyed being in the open. I think it just gave me time to heal.
Right.
And then somebody suggested that perhaps I should look into a religion. I had been brought up a Christian, and after my experiences of war And half the time it's all about religion. And I thought, I can't deal with a religion that has an outside deity telling me what to do or people telling me what to do. And then somebody said, why don't you look into Buddhism? And I said, I don't want to be Buddhist. That's a bit weird. They are, you know, they sing funny songs and have to wear special colours and don't eat meat. And they said, no, there's hundreds of different types of groups. And I suggest, why don't you look at the lay organisation called the Dzogchen Gakkai International? And I was given a book and I went to some of their meetings and I thought, wow, this is for me. And then I sort of slowly come to realise that actually, yes, I had to somehow find peace from within inside me before I could let it blossom out from me.
Would you say that your work throughout the decades has left you as a more optimistic human being or less?
More. But that's through my Buddhist practice.
Right. So that's
absolutely.
Right.
That's why I met Buddhism, is at one time I suddenly thought, wow, we can make a difference. This is how to do it. It doesn't matter what religion you are, you can do it. You can, and it's by transcending, rising above our differences, finding something we've got in common together and working on that rather than arguing about what we haven't got in common. They talk about chaos theory. The fluttering of a butterfly wing can affect a hurricane the other side of the world. And I believe very much now when I'm doing my Buddhist practice, I can affect wars in the other side of the world through what I'm doing here and now.
We're going to have your penultimate choice then. Tell me about the seventh disc of the morning. Why have you chosen this?
This is Dare to Believe. And actually, it's the Dzogchen Gakkai International, my Buddhist group. They did a show called Alice, based on Alice in Wonderland. And it was sung with 300 people on the stage. And it's saying that we all can stand up and make a difference. Just dare to believe you can do it. Believe in your dreams and just go for it.
That was Dare to Believe, sung by the Dzogchen Gakkai Choir, conducted by Peter Osborne. So, Claire Berchinger, earthquakes, tsunamis, civil wars, all of those horrors that are visited upon the world, it's easy for us to feel overwhelmed, to feel that we can do nothing. Given what you were just talking about, what do you think each of us can do to make a difference? Because mostly we feel all we can do is, you know, send some money to a charity.
There's so much you can do. You can send some money to a charity, but choose the charity you want. Check them up on the Charity Commission site. You can get involved. I work in Age UK shop, and you can give your old clothes, good clothes. You can go and buy things from the shop. So we can all do it in our little way at home and have a knock-on effect. And it might be just helping somebody in your own community, but just helping and supporting, this compassion has a knock-on effect.
We know how busy your life has been and how purposeful. Has there been much room for a personal life through all of this?
You know, my priority in life was not to get married and have children. It was never put on the back burner. It just didn't happen. I've had such a full and rich and exciting life, and it doesn't seem to stop. I suppose it's this dare to believe and grab in your dreams, and something pops up and I think, well, why not? I'll try that. And every year something exciting happens.
You're now a tutor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. You teach students how to deal with caring in what's known as resource-poor areas. These are students who are already highly trained as nurses. If you could just pick one bit of advice that you were going to give them before they went, given your experience, what would it be?
Goodness me. I think when they go there, listen to the people. Sit down, listen, have a cup of tea. Before you start telling them what they should do, find out why they're doing what they're doing.
Sound advice. Let's go to your last choice of the morning then. Tell me about this, Claire.
This is a fun one. It's Call Me Al from Gracelands by Paul Simon. I play it on the first day of the course. I have it at top blast as all the students come in and I think they don't know what's hit them, because I can tell you I'm not like a normal nursing tutor. I'm really try to motivate them to be self-sufficient, just like I was taught to be, because once they're in a resource-poor area as nurses, they're probably going to be the only medical person for hundreds of miles aligned. What if I die here? Who'll be my role model now that my role model is gone? Gone. He ducked back down the alley with some
roly-poly little bat-faced girl. All along, along, there were incidents and accidents. There were hints and allegations. If you'll be my bodyguard, I can be your long-lost pal. I can call you Daddy, and Daddy, when you call me, you can call me out, call me out.
Paul Simon, Call Me Al. So, Claire Birchinger, I'm going to give you the books now. Traditionally, people get the complete works of Shakespeare and also the Bible. Do you want to replace the Bible?
I'd like to replace it with Nichiren Daishonin, the writings of Nichiren Daishonin, please.
Right, for your Buddhist text. Right. You get to take another book as well. What book are you going to take?
I'd like a book of monologues, please.
Ah, right, I'll find you one. And a luxury too, something that might make life alone on this island a little better.
Can I take my little dog with me?
You absolutely cannot. It's got to be an inanimate object. You can't take a
can
living
thing.
Can I take
a Swiss Army penknife?
You can, actually.
Can I?
Yes. Right, that's yours. And if you were to have to save one of these eight tracks from the waves, which one would you save?
Call Me Al by Paul Simon.
Okay, that's yours. Dame Claire Birchinger, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
You're welcome, thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.